It is my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse, President and Founder of the Ruth Institute. Her new book, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims, is a collection of 35 prophetic essays written over the past two decades. Dr. Morse is one of the few academics who rightly foresaw the poisonous ideology of the sexual revolution and the pain, grief, and ultimately the loneliness that it has foisted on our culture even now. Her topic? The impact of redefining marriage on children and society.
We were so intent on our quick turnaround here with the short time in between the talks that we forgot the all-important free-range microphone here so I can be untethered to this crazy podium. Okay, great. Thank you so very much. Well, look at how many of you... Oh, you need to turn up the sound. How many of you were in the room this morning... John, there you go. Yay, okay. How many of you were in the room this morning when John was speaking, the gentleman from the United Kingdom? Is he here? Is he here today? Okay, wonderful. Listen, I work on the marriage issue all day long, and it is because of Molly that I am here to talk with Cleveland Right to Life, evidently one of the most vibrant life movements in the country. I hope he convinced you that you need to know something about this issue, all right? And I'm convinced that we need to know something about this issue. I think there's really only one issue here. I don't think life and marriage are separate issues. There's really only one giant issue, which I will explain to you as we go along. So I got this kind of funky title, but that's okay. What I'm going to be talking to you about is the marriage issue and how it fits in with the life issue in the broad spectrum of the sexual revolution. That's what we're going to be talking about. So first of all, I would like to invite all of you to join with the Ruth Institute, be part of what we're doing, and I want to introduce my son who is here. Nick, could you stand up here? This is my son, Nick. Many of you have been talking to him. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. It's really nice. He and a few of our friends here are going to circulate a clipboard that will give you the opportunity to sign up for the Ruth Institute monthly newsletter. It's all electronic. So, fellas, if you would just kind of circulate those clipboards for me, that would be great. All I need really is your electronic information, and we can send you that email address. So here are the goals of this presentation. I cannot give you all of the factual information that I have on this subject. I'm selling out there a four-lecture series. I'm not going to try to cram four lectures into one talk. I am not. One time I gave a lecture, and I had Nick wheel in a filing cabinet to show all of the evidence and data that I was aware of on this topic. And literally, I have a whole filing cabinet. I'm not going to do that to you today, okay? What I have are some very general goals for you. And I want you to just be aware that I've got a ton of information. And when you need something specific, you come back to us and you can get it, okay? We're not going to do a data dump here. That's not the idea. But what I mainly want you to do is I want you to walk out of here with confidence that the ancient teachings of the church are correct on this issue. Now, I know we have people of many denominations here, right? We're not all Roman Catholics. It sometimes sounds like we are, but we aren't. I know that. All the churches used to teach the very same things about these issues. Right up until 5 minutes ago, all the Christian denominations agreed and taught the same things. So I want you to understand that these teachings can be defended at the most rigorous level, and I want you to be proud of it. That's the main thing. I want this hanging around here that you just kind of, oh, you're violating my religious liberty. Please. Leave me alone so I can have my quirky, crazy religious beliefs that you have no respect for, and I'm just basically a snake-handling religion or a peyote cult, so leave me alone. That's got to stop. We are correct on the substance of the issues, and we've got to debate the issues, okay? So this is a big frustration for me and the marriage movement because I think we spend too much time talking about religious liberty. So anyway, those are the goals of my presentation. And the second one, the other main one, is that I know many of you have family members and relatives that you need to deal with on some aspect or another about the sexual revolution. And you want to hang in there with them for the long haul. You've got friends and neighbors whom you love who have gone off the rails. It doesn't matter if they've gone off the gay rails or they've gone off the divorce rails or they've gone off the abortion rails. We don't care about that. They're all off the rails, okay? And so you may be their only connection with Jesus Christ. Because when they go off the rails, their conscience bothers them. We heard John Henry Weston talking about this yesterday. When the conscience starts to bother you, you can either change your behavior or you can kill your conscience somehow. And so this is what we have to deal with. So you need to stay engaged, and having factual information and confidence is what's going to allow you to hang in there with people. So that's the real goal of what we're trying to get done here. So I need your help to get the mission of the Ruth Institute done. And the mission of the Ruth Institute is to inspire the survivors of the sexual revolution to recover from their negative experiences and then share their stories truthfully with the young. And so, obviously, I can't do that. Now, I had ordered a whole lot of material to provide for you guys to sell you, and we have this very cool kit that we made up and so on and so forth, and we had it mailed out, had all the elements mailed out, and about half of it is somewhere between here and San Diego in the bowels of the U.S. postal system. So it didn't make it here, which is, you know, as you can imagine, a person from San Diego, we don't hold with weather as an excuse for things to happen, but that's probably what is happening. But anyway, I created this special thing for you, which we call the Defending Marriage Kit, and it was already a very good value of tools that would allow you to talk to your friends and be informed and so on and so forth, but I can't offer it to you in this form that I had my slides prepared and everything, you know, because half of it, a lot of it, didn't make it. So I redid it, and I'll tell you about that later as we go through the presentation. But we do have a ton of helpful material for you to be able to talk about this. So the three things I want to talk with you about today, three main topics. First, what is the sexual revolution? Second, how does the so-called gay marriage issue fit in to the overall picture of the sexual revolution? That will take the bulk of our time. And then finally, how do we heal this culture in a permanent and lasting and Christ-like manner? In other words, what's the problem and what are we going to do about it? We're going to heal the culture in a Christ-like manner, because that's the only way that's worth doing. And that's the only way in the end that will last. Now, part of what we're dealing with here, part of what emerges from the sexual revolution, many people have alluded to this in various ways. I'm kind of glad to be the last speaker because I know all the good stuff you guys have been listening to, is that we have the strong and the powerful preying on the weak. The sexual revolution is not a liberation movement. I want you to understand that. It is a descent into barbarism. It's a descent into barbarism, where the strong are more and more able to prey upon the weak. Well, this is the perennial human problem that the Christian churches have tried to solve. Since 33 AD, the Christian religion has said, no, you don't get to do everything you want just because you're rich and powerful. And since 33 AD, the people who are rich and powerful have not liked that very much. So it's the same story in a different form. I do think it's more potent than a lot of the other things we've faced in the past, but we need to just have in perspective what this is. This is the perennial human problem. Okay, so what is the sexual revolution? There are two points that I define the sexual revolution to include two points, all right? The first is that sex and childbearing can be separated from one another, and that both can be separated from marriage. By the way, if you're signing this clipboard, I will send you a PDF of this PowerPoint presentation. Okay, I'll send you an electronic PDF of it so that you can have all of this stuff. Could I have that big slide back up there again so people can see it, because I'm going to be, they can see me. They need to see my picture. I mean, my, hello? You see what I'm talking about? Can I have that back? Okay, all right, so the sexual revolutionaries believe that it is possible to separate sex and procreation from one another, and that indeed a good and decent society must do so. And they believe that both can be separated from marriage. Do you recognize that as being a part of the culture we're dealing with? Sure. Yes, that's the underlying bedrock principle that kind of accounts for a lot of what you're seeing. The second point of the sexual revolution is the idea that men and women are completely interchangeable. that any differences that you see between men and women are entirely socially constructed and almost certainly unjustified. Do you recognize that as part of the world in which we live? Now, I'm not going to talk about that a lot, but I just want to allude to the fact of, as to how destructive that is at the very, very personal micro level. I mean, if you think about a husband and wife trying to negotiate their lives together, if they both think that the other person is supposed to be exactly like them, they're not going to get anywhere. They're going to have endless conflicts that are going to be extremely painful. And the more intimate the issue, the more it has to do with the body, such as with sexuality, such as with fertility, the harder it's going to be to negotiate, because we have this cultural message that I expect you to be exactly like me, and if you're not, one of us is defective, and I'm pretty sure it's not me, so it must be you. You need to act like I act. You need to feel like I feel. My husband and I, I'll just give you this one little story. My husband and I were really married singles for a long time. I don't know if you've ever heard that expression. It comes from marriage encounter people use this expression. You know, that we had our own little separate lives. And it was only when infertility hit our family that it became clear to me that we were actually men and women different, right? That was the first experience where our gender differences actually met, where we really, really, we in our face noticed that this meant something different to him than it meant to me, right? But throughout society, we're not supposed to even talk about the idea that men and women are somehow interchangeable. I put this illustration up here because I want you to look at that child. I didn't draw this illustration. This illustration comes from the Boston Globe, which was writing a puff piece about how wonderful it will be for children to be allowed to have six parents. So there's the child in the center, and there's the six adults out there, and they're all the parents, and of course it's going to be wonderful. No, no problem. Blah, 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 blah. I want you to look at that kid. You can't tell if that's a girl or a boy. That's not an accident. That's what the Boston Globe is drawing to make their point, okay? So do you see what I'm talking about here? That's the idea of the androgynous thing. That's what we're all supposed to be. Now, there's just one problem with these 2 points of the sexual revolution. Just one small, slight, miniature problem. Sex actually does make babies. Do you all know that? Whew, glad to hear that. Okay. And men and women actually are different. And kids do need their own moms and dads. And they have a strong preference for their own moms and dads. Absent something really crazy going on, kids want their own moms and dads. And marriage is a social institution that delivers the goods to kids. So all these points that I just mentioned on the previous slide, they're all false. Other than that, the sexual revolution, great idea, right? So as a result of it being false, what we're dealing with is a totalitarian ideology, because these people have taken it upon themselves as a high moral duty to do some things that cannot be done. Do you see the problem? Sure. Just like the communists thought that it was absolutely necessary to abolish private property and have a prosperous society, somehow they were going to do that, it was undoable. And so therefore, in order to do the impossible, it takes a lot of effort, it takes a lot of force, and it takes a lot of propaganda to maintain this kind of system. Because you have to be fed all the time with stuff that will keep you from going off the rails here and actually believing that, oh my gosh, sex actually does make babies. You know, one time I was in a debate, and I was debating a law professor, and I made this statement that I thought was perfectly unexceptional. I said, sex makes babies. She said, no, it doesn't. Oh, says I, what do you mean? And she said, unprotected sex makes babies. Oh, unprotected sex makes babies. That means if you get pregnant, you didn't use your contraception correctly, or you had a contraceptive failure. This is not a child here. This is a contraceptive failure. So the problem with the sexual revolution is that these little contraceptive failures keep popping up all the time, providing concrete evidence that sex actually does make babies. You see? And so you must somehow suppress all that. You all in the pro-life movement have dealt with many, many instances of this general principle. of things that you know to be true. The science is out there, and you're trying to promote the science, and nobody gives a rip about the science that you have, right? Yeah, you guys know what I'm talking about? I don't need to give you the examples. Your mind can come up with all kinds of examples like this, right? Right? So this is why we're dealing with it. And so the issue I'm dealing with on the marriage side has exactly this point in common with you all on the life side. All right? So therefore, this is a pagan, anti-life, anti-human body ideology, and no Christian should have anything to do with it. And the reason we are where we are today, I would submit to you, is that previous generations of Christian leaders have not understood the depth and the significance of what they were dealing with. Because it's always some little thing. It's just this one little thing we want. All we want to do is allow abortion in the case of rape and incest. All we want to do is allow divorce to be easier for people who would have gotten divorced in any case, so we'll just have no-fault divorce and do away with all these evidence-based proceedings that are so costly and foolish and so on and so forth. So we have misunderstood the depth of what we're dealing with, and that's why we are where we are. Now, unfortunately, the sexual revolution has been with us for a long time, and I have just come out with a new book. And fellas, where are my helpers? Can I have my helpers come? Let the clipboard keep going around. Fellas, would you come and get these little cards and pass them out for me? I have just created a book called The Sexual Revolution and its Victims. The Sexual Revolution and its Victims. And who is that on the cover? Who's the image? Marilyn Monroe. She's a perfect metaphor for this whole problem because she's beautiful, she's glamorous, and airbrushed. The pain of her life, her short, tragic life, is all airbrushed out of the picture. And that's how the sexual revolution has proceeded. It looks so wonderful. It's going to be so great. Airbrush, 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 airbrush. According to her biographer, she had had 12 abortions before she was 29. It's almost unbelievable. Almost unbelievable. Norman Mailer claimed that. He was married to her for a while, so I suppose he knows. Anyway, we created this book. This book is so new, it's going to the printer when I get back to San Diego. Okay, it's that new. And so we've created a special offer for all of you here at this convention. $20 for this book. Tuck it in the envelope, fill out the card, and we'll send it to you. Free shipping, autographed copy of this book, The Sexual Revolution and its Victims. Whole series of essays about contraception, abortion, cohabitation, huge issue, divorce, all these different types of issues that have been with us for a long time. I've been writing about this for 20 years and finally figured out it was all one giant thing, right? So that's the theme of this book, and we want to make that available to you. So secondly, oh, are you clapping for me? Thank you. That's very nice. That's very nice. Okay, so how does the so-called gay marriage issue fit into the overall picture of the sexual revolution? Now, I avoid saying the term gay marriage, which might have confused people, because the title that was in the program didn't say gay marriage, so maybe people didn't get that that's what it was about. So if you have any friends who are wandering around or, you know, doing something that they don't get what this is about, send them a text and tell them to get in here. This is about gay marriage, okay, if they're not sure. But I don't use that term. Why do I not use the term gay marriage? Because there's no such thing as a gay marriage. You can imagine a pink unicorn. That doesn't mean there is such a thing. Okay? So I use other terms for it. I use the phrase redefine marriage. We're talking about redefining marriage. Now, redefining marriage is a very handy phrase because you can then use the phrase, and you might want to write this down, redefining marriage redefines parenthood. That you can almost fit on a bumper sticker. It doesn't take you 2 hours to refute or to explain. Redefining marriage redefines parenthood. And when you say that, you're sending your listener's mind off down a trail that is more where we want them to go than if you allow yourself to say gay marriage, which doesn't exist, or you allow yourself to say, God forbid anybody in this room should ever use the term marriage equality. Okay, that's their term that changes the basis of the discussion. You don't want to go there. Do not carry water for your opponents. All right? You all learned this in the pro-life movement. I'm here to explain just a few ways in which you might inadvertently be carrying water for your opponents on the marriage issue, all right? So don't use that term. I like the term genderless marriage. I like to say sometimes a big, long, clunky phrase, we are removing the gender requirement from marriage, because that's what we're doing. We're removing the gender requirement from marriage. And now the person's got to think, well, what the heck are they talking about? And if they say that to you, what the heck are you talking about? You can say, well, you know, we've redefined the birth certificates. We've rewritten the marriage licenses. You know, something's different here. We've removed the word husband and wife from the law. I no longer have a husband in California. I have a partner. Nobody has a husband anymore. Gay or straight, nobody has a husband. Nobody has a wife. That's gone out of the law. So there are a couple of things that you have to believe in order to believe that this redefined marriage thing is a real thing, that it's even possible, much less that it's desirable. There are three things that you have to believe, and you'll see the relationship between these things and the sexual revolution overall. First thing you have to believe is that marriage is principally about adults and their desires, and only secondarily about children and their needs. That's the first thing you have to believe, that marriage is about adults and how they feel and what they want, and kids are kind of along for the ride. Do we already believe that in this culture? Yes, we do. How do we come to that conclusion? No-fault divorce was a big thing that pushed us into the direction of thinking that, right? No-fault divorce says that kids have no need or entitlement to a permanent relationship between their parents. Children have no interest in the stability of their parents' union. The only thing that matters is what the adults want. And so we have a regime of unilateral divorce, which removed the presumption of permanence and also removed the presumption of sexual exclusivity from marriage. That's what no-fault divorce did. So that pretty much tells you that we think marriage is about adults and what they want. That's what we're doing there. Secondly, you have to believe that sex is intrinsically a sterile activity. You have to believe that sex just doesn't really matter that much. Sex is a sterile activity with babies thrown in as an afterthought if you happen to have quirky lifestyle preferences. That's what you have to believe this. And so do we already believe that in this culture? We certainly do. Contraception, abortion, we're even talking about infanticide, toddlercide. I've never heard that word, but, you know, how's any kid going to run the gauntlet of surviving until they have rational faculties or whatever Peter Singer thinks they should have? How many kids are going to meet that criterion? It's crazy. But that's kind of what we think now, that we're entitled to unlimited sexual activity without a baby ever showing up. That's what we're entitled to. So therefore, we've got this untrue thing that we're trying to do. And then finally, you've got to believe that men and women are interchangeable in order to believe that a union of two men is the same as a union of two women, which should already be telegraphed to you that there's something wrong with this, because two men in the room and two women in the room are really not the same sort of thing. And respect to any kind of thing, but anyway, and that they're all equivalent to a man and a woman. You have to already believe those things. So there we are with the key elements of the sexual revolution already in place in our minds and to some extent in our laws, paving the way for genderless marriage. And if you really listen to people on the other side on this issue, what you'll find is that in their minds, they've already redefined marriage. In their minds, marriage is already a genderless, sexless thing, and they can't figure out what's wrong with us. Why don't we get along with the program and just take the final legal step of removing the gender requirement from the marriage? That's what they want to know. And that's why they think we're irrational bigots, because they can't figure it out. So I'd like to do a thought experiment to explain what difference redefined marriage is actually going to make in people's lives. If you look at these three people here, I'd like to ask you to consider, what does society owe these three people? It is most probably a mother and a father and a baby. They look alike with those genetically engineered sunglasses. Right, so we assume they're actually related to each other. Now, some people might say society owes them subsidized housing or free education or all kinds of things. But I want to say there's something much more basic that society owes to these three people. Society owes it to them to say that these two people are the parents of this child and no one else is. There are no other comers to say, I'm the parent. Not your grandma. Grandma doesn't get parental rights. Next door neighbor who has a PhD in child psychology, she doesn't get parental rights. Your previous boyfriend doesn't get parental rights. Those two people are the parents of the child and no one else is. Now, how does marriage accomplish something like that? This is the phrase to keep in your minds as you're debating this issue. What is the essential public purpose of marriage? The essential public purpose of marriage is to attach mothers and fathers to their children and to one another. That's the purpose of marriage. It's essential in the sense that if you didn't need to get this purpose done, no one would have ever thought of lifelong sexual fidelity. Nobody would have ever thought of marriage if you didn't need to attach kids to their parents. If we were different types of creatures, we wouldn't need that reproduced some other way. You wouldn't be bothering with an institution like marriage. But as it is, every known society has, or at least used to have, something like marriage, man-woman marriage. Now, it's a public purpose and not a private purpose, as opposed to a private purpose, because this is the reason that the society as a whole has an institution of marriage. This is why you have marriage. So you as an individual might have all kinds of reasons, personal, private reasons for wanting to get married. You want to be queen for the day and wear a beautiful dress, and you want to get a health insurance, or you want to get your parents to stop bugging you. When are you going to marry? When are you guys going to get married? You might want to irritate your previous boyfriend. You could have all kinds of private, personal reasons for wanting to get married. But all taken together, they don't add up to a public reason to have the institution of marriage in the first place. That's the key thing, okay? And so same-sex couples are obviously different for this purpose from opposite-sex couples. Now, this is important because the courts, when the courts rule on this question, under American law, it is okay to treat different things differently. If two groups are different with respect to important public purpose, then okay, you can treat them differently under American law. So what the marriage redefiners must do is to redefine the purpose of marriage. They must redefine the public purpose of marriage. Well, let me take just a moment to explain how marriage gets this job done. Gets the job done through something called the presumption of paternity. So if we think our job is here, we want to attach children to their mothers and fathers and those mothers and fathers to each other. If that's the job we're trying to get done, how do we get it done? Well, when a baby is born, there's usually a mother somewhere close by. Would you agree with that? Okay, yeah, we usually know who's the mom. The problem is, who's the daddy? Marriage answers this question by saying the mother's husband is presumed to be the father, the pater, of any children that she gives birth to during the life of their union. That's how marriage establishes the attachment of the mother and father to their children and to one another. That's how it works. Now, if you have a same-sex couple, obviously, in 100% of the cases, the same-sex partner is not the child's other parent. Would you agree with that? On basic biology. Okay, so what they have had to do is to do a basic sleight of hand to redefine the presumption of paternity into a presumption of parentage. So therefore, this is how you get to a situation where children are no longer being attached to their biological parents as a natural traditional marriage would do, but they're being removed through IVF, through sperm donation, through surrogacy, egg donation, all of those types of institutions are basically the law is coming between the child and one of its parents and attaching them to a new person. In some cases, you end up with three legal parents, four legal parents, and so on. And, you know, if the Boston Globe has its way, six legal parents, okay? That's how this is happening. This is how it's being detached. And so since this is the public purpose of marriage, it always has been the public purpose of marriage, to attach children to their mothers and fathers and to one another, the guys who want to redefine marriage must get rid of that public purpose for marriage. They must get rid of it. It's not enough to just scoot it down the list and say it's one of several purposes. It has to be off the list. So this particular judge here, this is Judge Von Walker, who overturned Proposition 8. And the quotation I have on the screen is what he gave as his position of what is the purpose of marriage for under the law. He says, marriage is the state recognition and approval of a couple's choice to live with one another, to remain committed to one another, and to form a household based on their own feelings about one another, and to join in an economic partnership and support one another and any dependents, close quote. The babies are off the list. I tell my students, if you guys are rooming together over the course of the semester, do not share too much money with each other or you'll end up married under Judge Walker's definition of marriage. Okay? There's nothing left of marriage here but a government registry of friendships. There's no public purpose left. Why does the government care about any of this stuff? It's kind of crazy. So, to just reiterate, at the Ruth Institute, we are always about protecting the rights and interests of children. We're interested in the born children, you're interested in the unborn children. We're kind of interested in the unborn children, too, because we're trying to get people to think about what they're doing before they even conceive the child, okay? A child has a legitimate entitlement to a relationship with both parents. They have the right to know who they are. They have identity rights, which are wiped out by third-party reproduction. And therefore, they have an interest in the stability of their parents' union. We need to defend these rights proactively, not after the fact. And so this is why we have to always ask ourselves what is owed to the child. Now, what I'd like to do before I go any further is to read to you something that I composed literally in 2010, almost 5 years ago, for something that took place in the Diocese of Oakland, California. At that time, the Bishop of Oakland, California was Salvatore Cordeleone, who is a very stalwart defender of natural marriage. He's considered the father of Proposition 8. And so I wrote this thing in 2010 to explain what I thought would happen if we redefine marriage. And so I'd like to share that with you now. This is an account of what the city of Oakland would look like 30 years from now if the trends continue towards redefining marriage. So I want you to picture yourself 30 years from now. You and your grandson are going to a private prayer meeting at an apartment building in Oakland. You've been there often enough that you know a lot of the people sitting on the steps or out in the yard. There's old Mrs. Garcia. She's raising her grandchildren. Her daughter got caught up in drugs and men and went off the deep end. Her three grandchildren have different fathers. She hopes she can keep the kids, but you never know what the courts will decide. There's Miss Marisol. Her little girl lives with her some of the time, but when she broke up with her boyfriend, he went to court to claim that he was the de facto parent and he should have shared custody. He was doing it to be mean to her and because he wanted to have access to the little girl, if you know what I mean. Under the de facto parenting law, he counted as a parent because he spent enough time with the child and she used to call him daddy. So Marisol's daughter is with her old boyfriend part-time and she can't do anything to stop it. She didn't fight too hard because she had a friend named Lisa who used to live in the same apartment complex. Lisa got her daughter taken away from her completely. Lisa went into hiding with her daughter when the court ordered her to return the little girl to her former girlfriend part-time. Somebody saw her, told on her, and she got found. The little girl was taken away, and Lisa actually did jail time. So Marisol figured she was better off not fighting with her ex. Then there's Sherry and Rebecca. They're married to each other. They don't have sex with each other. They have sex with men, but nobody cares about that. They each have two kids with different guys, so there are four kids with four different dads, which actually means no dads. They each raise their own kids under the same roof. They share health insurance, but that's about it. Of course, there are a few guys around. Billy Joe Bob just hangs around his mom's apartment. He's got a couple of kids by a couple different women. He doesn't feel any obligation to support any of them because he doesn't love any of these women or their brats. The courts have decided that, after all, love makes a family. Besides, Billy Joe Bob makes sure he doesn't earn very much money anyhow, so he doesn't pay. His mom yells at him a lot, but he just laughs at her and does as he pleases. Then there's Luke. Luke got married to Sam when they were in the military. They thought it would be cool to get off-base housing. They figured when their tour of duty was up, they'd get divorced and it would all be cool. But Sam got greedy and decided to sue Luke for his pension. Luke ended up broke and living in this broken-down joint. Then there's little Ned. He has two mommies and two daddies. I should say he started off with two mommies and two daddies. They quarreled amongst themselves. They went to court over his custody and worked out an elaborate plan for sharing parenting amongst the four of them. Most of them got tired of being on the cutting edge of social change and lost interest in Ned. He used to cry at school every day because he never knew who was coming to pick him up. Now Ned lives here with his natural mom, Janet. Sometimes one of the fathers or the other mother will come over and demand to see him and take him out on an outing, but his story actually ended pretty well because most of these people pretty much leave him alone now. Then there's Emily. Emily was bought and paid for by a guy who wanted a little girl. Of course, no one would marry this creeper. So he bought an egg, hired a surrogate, and used his own sperm to have a little girl. The law now says that artificial reproduction is a service and children are a commodity and anyone who can pay can do anything they want. Anyhow, Emily's teacher figured out something weird was going on and called Child Protective Services. So now Emily lives here with her teacher. But she had lived with her dad, or maybe I should say her manufacturer, for 7 years before anybody figured out what was going on. And then there's Tom. You can't look at Tom without thinking of the old saying, nice guys finish last. He married some guy from Latin America who wanted a green card. They both agreed that they'd get divorced as soon as the immigration deal was sealed. But while that was going on, his husband, Alejandro, acquired a live-in girlfriend. She got pregnant. They used to ask Tom to help look after the baby while they partied. He didn't think much of it. He was trying to help out and be a nice guy. When the time came for them to get divorced, he found himself sucked into a child support suit. Unbeknownst to him, the law of marriage says that any child born to one partner during the life of their union is automatically the child of both. So he got stuck for child support. They had it planned out from the beginning. Like I said, nice guys finish last. So you go up the steps to the prayer meeting at Miss Lila's apartment. Not too many people are coming these days. Today it's just Miss Lila, Mrs. Garcia, and old Mr. and Mrs. Villanueva. They used to be very active in Couples for Christ, a worldwide Filipino organization for married couples, but some same-sex couples wanted to join, and the organization tried to accommodate them, but the couples didn't feel at home because so many of the Couples for Christ programs talked about how men and women should treat each other and talk to one another, and so the same-sex couples sued. The judge made Couples for Christ take out everything that had to do with sex differences. There wasn't much point to the organization after that. And old Mr. and Mrs. Villanueva didn't quite know what to do with themselves after the organization closed. So Miss Lila brought out the old plaster statue from its hiding place, and everybody brought out their prayer beads. They said their prayers for a while and drank coffee, and you and your grandson left. As you got on the train, you told your grandson, back in the day, these BART trains used to go all over the place. There aren't too many now. You remember hearing back at the turn of the 21st century, how much money the government was spending on taking care of kids without their parents. Back then, it cost the U.S. government the equivalent of the GDP of New Zealand, $112 billion per year. You don't want to think about what it costs today. So you get on the train and you told your granddad, so as you're riding along, your grandson says, why is Miss Lila so sad? Well, her brother used to be the Bishop of Oakland. He's been in jail for the last 10 years. She's praying for him all the time. Why did he go to jail? You know that high school over on Fruitvale Avenue? Sure, Vaughn Walker High School. That used to belong to the Catholic Church. His eyes get wide. The church used to have schools? Yeah, well, that church used to be called St. Elizabeth Ann Seton School. You couldn't bear to tell him that she had been a pioneer of Catholic education in America. He wouldn't have understood. The city tried to tell the bishop that the Catholic schools had to teach stuff that he didn't want to teach. Oh, what kind of stuff? Like God knew what he was doing when he created men and women different. Marriage between a man and a woman. Kids need a mom and dad. Stuff like that. His eyes really get wide now because he hasn't seen either of his parents in a long time. A lot of people started coming to the Catholic schools because they wanted kids to learn that stuff and nobody else was teaching it. One day, the police came to force them to get rid of some books. All the parents came to the school to guard their kids and their books, and the bishop blocked the doorway. The police took him away. Some of the parents tried to fight back, but when the police came and started taking kids away to put them in foster care, most of the parents gave up. The bishop is still in jail. He was one tough guy. Secretly, a lot of people admire him but are afraid to say anything. You aren't afraid, are you, Grandpa? That's why we go over to Miss Lila's, isn't it? That's right. Grandpa, you fought for the bishop, didn't you? Long silent pause. The BART train rattles on. Grandpa, you didn't do nothing to help the bishop, did you? No, I didn't do nothing. Here's our stop. Let's go watch the Raiders play ball. So you and your grandson get out of the BART at the end of the line at the crumbling Colosseum, the last remnant of what was once a great civilization. My friends, this is what our future could be if we don't do something about it. But fortunately, we can do something about it. Do you agree that you want to do something about it? Are you there? Okay. And time is not on our side. We need to do something now. So this little talk that I gave is one of the talks that is on this CD called Defending Marriage with Dr. J. This CD has that talk that you just heard, and it has two other talks, which are my testimonies in front of state legislatures here in the United States. That's part of this Defending Marriage kit that we put together for you, which I'll tell you a little bit more about in a minute. We also have this four lecture set that I mentioned to you, four CDs, four audio DVDs, I beg your pardon. So how are we going to heal this culture in a Christ-like and lasting way? Well, it's now time for my helpers to pass out the purple brochures. Fellas, would you put a package of 10 brochures on every one of the tables? I think we should have enough for everybody. We need to think about the fact that there have been victims of the sexual revolution from the very beginning. Marilyn Monroe was just the start. We think about the adult children of divorce. We think about post-abortive women. There was a lady here wearing a button, an older lady wearing a button, say, I regret my abortion, okay? We think about the reluctantly divorced. The reluctantly divorced. Have you ever heard that term before? We made it up at the Ruth Institute. What I mean by that term is a person who wished they could have stayed married, but their spouse wanted a divorce. The government takes sides with the person who wants the marriage the least. That's what we're dealing with. So, I also put on there the heartbroken career woman. That happens to be me. You heard my whole bio of all the accomplishments that I had, and then I got to be 35 years old, wanted babies, couldn't have any. There are a lot of women like me who've had that kind of experience. All of us are victims of the earlier phases of the sexual revolution. The things that I mentioned here in this story, the out-of-control third-party reproduction, that's what's coming down the pike if we lose the marriage issue. That's what's coming at us. The buying and selling of children, that's part of what's coming at us, okay? So we have victims now. We're going to have more victims. The homosexuals, the people who are same-sex attracted, whether they're men or women, people who are same-sex attracted, they are, in a sense, also victims, aren't they? Because what all of us have in common is that we are being lied to. We have been told one big fat lie after another. And so what we want to do, our strategy at the Ruth Institute is very simple. We want to reach out to all of these people and offer them help and healing. So if you open up this little pamphlet, on the first side over here, you have the list of survivors. We've come up with a list of 12 survivors of the sexual revolution. There are probably others, and you can probably tell us more about it. But this is overwhelming enough, isn't it, to look down this list of all of these people? A lot of times people look at this and they go, like my printer, when we picked this up from the printer said to me, I know somebody in every one of these categories. And probably most of you know people in a lot of these categories. Instead of being freaked out, overwhelmed, and running and hiding under the bed, our strategy is this. We want to look at all of these people as potential allies. Why are they potential allies? Because they have suffered. Just like the pro-life movement figured out that the woman who's getting the abortion is not our enemy, we need to also see a lot of these other people as not our enemy, but as in fact our potential allies. They are the walking wounded, And so we want to give them practical methods to improve their situation. We want to help them connect the dots. And what did I do with my clicker? Here we go. We want to give them methods to connect the dots between what happened to them and what they're going through now. And on this page, we have all the lies that people were told. See, the very first one kind of up there towards the top, children of divorce, kids are resilient. Kids are resilient. You know what? I have a colleague who's a child of divorce. She wants to throw up every time she hears somebody say that, right? Because it's a lie. And people get divorced and do all kind of crazy stuff based on that lie. The big lie of all is right across the bottom. Right across the bottom. Having sex is the key to happiness and the solution to all your problems. That's the big lie we're all being told. See? So instead of being afraid of all these people, we have to reach out to them and make allies out of them. And so that's what we're trying to do at the Ruth Institute. So if we start from this perspective, that the sexual revolution has produced victim after victim after victim, and then we go and start talking to people who are dealing with same-sex attraction and who want society to change in certain ways because they think it's going to help them, we can credibly say to them, look, the sexual revolution didn't work for us. Why do you think it's going to work any better for you? Whether you're a same-sex attracted person or a pornography addict or whatever it is not going to work any better for you than it did for the rest of us. Please join with us. You heard John Henry Weston yesterday say that he was a victim. He didn't call himself a victim. He said he had a past of sexual dysfunction, I think he said. And he has used that, allowed himself to be transformed so that he can reach out for others. I'm challenging all of you who might have that kind of thing in your past to not be afraid of it. Right? And when you encounter people, to be able to reach out for them. And that's what we're trying to train people to do with these materials that we've developed. Because really and truly, what people need is more love. See, this crazy thing that you're going to be happier if you have sex, what does that appeal to? It doesn't just appeal to the animal instinct. It also appeals to people's desire for reliable love. Everybody wants reliable love. And all the things of the sexual revolution are undermining that. Not helping it, but actively undermining it. So, therefore, our policy, our goal, is to have more love inside the family so that people don't freak out and head for the exits. Because that's what happened to us all in the 50s, isn't it? A lot of us had problems in our families in the 50s, and the sexual revolution came along and said, wow, that sounds great. I can walk out of here and it'll all be great. But that isn't really what we needed. What we really needed was more love inside the family. So that's why we have these tips booklets on how to have a happier marriage and all of that. That's how that all fits in. So the other virtue of dealing with this way is that we're not singling anybody out for special treatment. We're not saying, sometimes on the marriage side, people hear us as follows. I think they hear pro-marriage people saying, you know what, we like the sexual revolution just fine. It's just the gay bits that we don't like. See, if we're silent about divorce and cohabitation and contraception and all these other issues and just go after the gay stuff, it's like that's not very credible. I don't think that's very credible. And the political people have been doing that quite a lot, and I think that it's harmed us. So there's a time for friendship, there's a time for love, there's a time for engaging people in a loving way. And there was a film called Carol, The Man Who Would Be Pope. I suppose you know who Carol is there. That's Carol Wojtyla. They quote him in there as saying, when he was living under Nazi occupation, he said, if we do not win through love, the evil will just come back in a different form. And did it not come back in a different form under communism? And is it not back in another form with the whole sexual revolutionary ideology, which is beyond left and right? Do not get hung up on left and right, liberal and conservative. It is beyond that. It is its own ideology. So that's why. So then the next final question I want to leave you with is, when we give great arguments and great evidence and, you know, all kind of information, why do people not listen? Why do people not hear it? You guys have the same problem that we have on the marriage side. You can have your little models of fetal development and all that kind of stuff. People don't get it. Why don't they get it? The answer is a guilty conscience. The guilty conscience problem is core to our mission. If we don't solve the guilty conscience problem, we're never going to get anywhere. Because when you say sex belongs in marriage, they might believe that. But if they're doing the wrong thing, what you're going to get is, this big protective gush to protect that guilty conscience. And John Henry Weston talked about that yesterday as well. So we had developed something to deal with that. We developed a little booklet, a handbook called The Seven Steps to Sexual Peace, which we felt like would be really helpful and everything like that. Unfortunately, that was going to be in the kit, but that's one of the things that's somewhere between here and San Diego in the mail. So we were going to include that in this kit that we would... And isn't that, look at this charming woman up here. I mean, would you follow her? Okay. Thank you, thank you. I have a new picture now. It's a better picture. But that wasn't a bad picture, was it? Okay, so we have the Defending Marriage kit now that doesn't have everything in it that we promised. So let me tell you what's in it. The four lecture set, Defending Marriage with Dr. J, a booklet called The Government's Duty to Marriage. Now listen up. Any of you Americans, I know not everybody here is American. Anybody in America, have you ever heard somebody say, we got to get the government out of the marriage business? Anybody ever heard that? This booklet deals with that. It explains why that's impossible and preposterous, actually. Okay. Also in there, we have a study guide to go with this DVD set. So you can show these four lectures and have questions and answers. Have a little, you can do it in your school, you can do it in your home, you can do it however you want to do it. And then we have the pamphlet, the seven steps, the 12 survivor pamphlet that you already have. So since we had a good deal there, we were going to offer this for $50, $85 worth of value. Half the printing didn't come. So what I'm doing is putting in an extra copy of Defending Marriage with Dr. J and an extra copy of the DVD set, which just sells for $30 on our website. And the reason I'm giving you this, and this is over $100 worth of value for $50. Now, why am I giving you this kind of deal? Because you're going to want to listen to this thing and then give it to your pastor. Here's a copy here for you to give to your pastor. What did he say this morning? You've got to confront your pastor in a nice way, of course. You're all nice people. You're not going to go scream at him. But, Father, would you listen to this? Would you be willing to listen to this, Father? Father, here, I'm going to donate this to the church library, Father, so that people can use it, so that people can inform themselves. So you've got double copies of the two most, I would say, highly valued items in the kit that are the audio-visual materials. Why are we doing that? Because I want to see Cleveland be built up and the whole spectrum of issues that have to do with the culture of life. You guys are doing such a great job on the life side. Molly and your executive people get it that you got to do something about the marriage side, and I'm here to do it. And I hope that you will join us out there at the book table when we're done. Great deal. My son and I will be there to help you with it, and I'm now ready for questions.
You have been listening to Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, President and Founder of the Ruth Institute.